This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Amy Bauer was an undergraduate studying physics at Tufts University when she noticed that her vision was getting blurry. Later, as a graduate student in Rhode Island, she got the official diagnosis. She was going blind. Macular degeneration and retinitis pigmentosa would gradually take away her sight. The news hit her, understandably, pretty hard. She thought she would have to give up her dream of being an oceanographer. But instead, 30 years later, Amy Bauer is at the top of her field, a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, doing groundbreaking work on some of the world's deepest ocean currents. She's also now paving the way for visually impaired young people to pursue science with a program she started with the Perkins School for the Blind in 2007. It's called Ocean Insight, and we'll talk about that program later on. Right now, Amy Bauer joins me in our Woods Hole studio. Amy, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, you are an undergraduate physics major. When did you first start thinking about ocean physics?
When I was probably my sophomore year, I had always been interested in the outdoors. That stems back to my growing up in Rockport, Massachusetts. And my mom in particular was very enthusiastic about the outdoors and the environment. And we spent a lot of time doing outdoor activities. And I lived on the coast. So I was quite drawn to the ocean from a young age. And when I went to Tufts University for physics, I realized pretty quickly that it wasn't atomic physics that I was interested in, but the physics of the Earth environment. So I was leaning towards things like geology, meteorology, maybe oceanography. But I didn't really get hooked on oceanography until I did Sea Semester from Sea Education Association, also here in Woods Hole.
Right here, yeah.
Yeah. So that's when I discovered that there was a way I could combine my training in math and physics with my love of the oceans.
You now study deep ocean currents. What is so important about those currents, and what are the kinds of questions that keep you intrigued?
The deep ocean currents, especially in the North Atlantic Ocean, are part of a global current system that we call the several things. It can be called the meridional overturning circulation, which is a mouthful. it can be called the more convenient Great Ocean Conveyor. And this is a series of currents that are responsible for transferring excess heat from the equator towards the poles. Because the way the Earth is shaped and the way the sun hits the Earth, more heat is absorbed by the Earth system at the equators than at the poles. So the atmosphere and the ocean currents have to redistribute that heat. Otherwise, the equator would just continue to heat up and the poles cool down. So these currents help the Earth system stay in a more or less steady state. And the deep ocean currents are part of this conveyor. So if you can imagine a conveyor belt, say, starting at the equator of the North Atlantic, going northward at the surface with extra warm water. And then as those waters move northward, they cool off, they get heavier. And when they get to the far northern North Atlantic, they sink down and return to the equator as very cold, deep, dense waters. And those are the currents that I'm most interested in.
In order to study those currents, how much do you have to go to sea? How much do you have to be out on ships?
As a group, my group needs to be at sea basically every year. I myself don't go every year. I usually go if I'm going to be the chief scientist for the expedition. But lately, I've been involved in very large collaborative programs looking at these deep and shallow parts of the conveyor belt. Sometimes another scientist in the group is chief scientist. I did go on a cruise in 2014 as a co-principal investigator. There were actually four of us co-principal investigators on the same cruise.
Leading by committee.
Yes, but there could only be one chief scientist, and there was only one, and it was not me that time. But prior to that, when's the last time? I think in 2011 probably was the last time I was at sea as a chief scientist. But my group and technicians and students go to sea almost every year.
What is the state of your vision at this point? Mm-hmm. How would you describe that?
Right. I have macular degeneration and retinitis pigmentosa, as you mentioned at the beginning. And those are degenerative conditions of the retina where the cells in the retina just slowly degenerate. So it's not the kind of eye condition that can be corrected with glasses or contact lenses. And so the state of my vision now is I can see, say, a light bulb that's on. I can see a window that light is coming from. In a well-lit room, I might even see the table, the chairs, sort of the general layout of the room. And kind of surprisingly, if I'm looking at my computer screen and I blow up the letters, zoom in, I can actually see the letters on a computer screen. And that's because there's one sliver of the retina near the macula, that's the center part of the retina, that is used for fine vision. And I have one sliver of that that remains. And so but it's kind of like looking through the paper towel tube or something like that, you know, in terms of the field of view is very narrow. So if I can get what I need to look at into that field of view, then I can see it if it's well lit and magnified somewhat.
Given that, what is it like for you to be on an ocean research vessel?
It's a challenge, I will say that. Number one, I set up my computer workstation just as I would have it in my office here at HUI. And that includes some adaptive technology that we'll get into in a bit. And then I have to familiarize myself with the ship. I use a guide dog for most of my days here on land, but when I go to sea, I use a white mobility cane, and I just have to familiarize myself with, you know, where all the ladders are, where my cabin is. And some people think that it's actually could be extremely challenging. And there are parts of it that are challenging. The movement is challenging because I have my cane in one hand. I have to hold on with the other hand, which leaves no hands for carrying anything. In fact, especially when our daughter was young and there were toys scattered all over the floor, that was a more hazardous environment than a research vessel.
Much, much more unpredictable.
Yes, exactly. A research vessel, everything is tied down, at least in theory. The walkways are, you know, by necessity kept clear. Once I learn the layout, I go from my cabin to the dining hall, the mess hall, to the lab, out on deck to kind of take part in what's going on out there and back again. So there aren't a lot of pathways that I have to memorize.
You were involved in the design of the newest ship that Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution recently took over operation of, the RV Armstrong. And the main deck of that, the main science deck, is handicap accessible in many ways. What are some of the adaptations that you wanted to see put into that ship's design for visually impaired scientists?
Let's see. The most important parts, I would say, are good lighting. Because, in fact, most people who are legally blind or significantly visually impaired are not totally blind, and they can benefit from good lighting. I've seen some adaptations on a vessel that is operated by the University of Alaska. I've seen in detail the Sukuliak, and some of the adaptations they've made, they have Braille labels on all the labs and cabins. If I need to go wake up someone coming on for the next watch, you know, I have to be able to find their cabin. So Braille and tactile labels.
And that's something that they're having to shift every 3 to 6 weeks as scientists and crews are coming and going.
Well, as long as the room number is there, and then there's a chart which has which scientist is in which room. So that would do it. So at least the cabin number. Tactile under the foot, I call them Tic Tacs. You know, people see them at sidewalk curb cuts often.
Oh, right. The little bumps on the edge of the sidewalk at a crosswalk.
Exactly. If there are those at the bottoms and tops of ladders, or that's what we call stairways on a ship, That can be very informative for when you're coming up to a stairwell, and also around any edges. Although, you know, the ships are so safe, the bulwarks or the sides, the walls of the ship on the deck are very safe and high. I mean, it would take a lot for me to walk off the edge of the deck. I mean,
so, that's good.
Yeah, exactly. So those are some of the, you know, and also the hallways, having the hallways sort of straight with not too many obstacles, like sticking out into the hallways, like fire extinguishers or other or safety boxes, if those can be inset into the walls so that the walls are a little bit smoother. A lot of visually impaired people use, as well as their cane or their guide dog, they use wall trailing, which is where you just put your fingers on the wall, your fingers pointing backwards, so you don't jam your fingers, you know, and you just lightly follow the wall as you go down a corridor. But if there are a lot of obstacles, the Knorr, I love the ship, but it was had been retrofitted so many times, there were thousands of little obstacles in the hallways that made it hard to navigate. So smooth passageways are another great way to make it easier to get around.
In case you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Bauer. She's a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Now, a couple of weeks ago, our producer, Elsa Partan, visited you in your office at Woods Hole Oceanographic to see some of the software that you use to help you get through your workday, even just with email. The software called Job Access with Speech, or JAWS, which I don't know if that makes it sound accessible or not. Anyway, so can you describe a little bit of how this software works, and then we'll actually hear an example of it at work?
Sure. JAWS I have been using for probably 20 years now, and it is an indispensable adaptive technology that I use to access the computer. It basically speaks to me everything that I either type or want to read on the computer. So as I'm typing an email, it will parrot. I have it set so that every word, when I finish typing a word, it will say that word out loud, so I can be sure that what I typed is what I wanted to be said. Likewise, I hit a special keystroke, and it will read the text content of any email or scientific paper or internet web page. And it's come a long way. It started out very robotic sounding voice and difficult to listen to. And when you hear a sample, you may say it still sounds robotic, but it's better than it used to be. And there are many voice choices now. You can have it speak to you as a female voice, an Australian voice, you know, South African English voice. many different dialects of English are possible now.
Well, let's hear a little bit of what it actually does sound like. This is when Elsa visited you.
Here's a work-related message.
Yes,
that's good news. That's great news.
Wow, did you understand that?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you just repeat the gist of the email for the people who didn't understand?
Sure. Yeah, the gist of the email is that a colleague in the UK who I've asked to deploy a mooring for me in a cruise this summer is saying it looks likely, which is a great help for me. So I'm really happy about that. But I can also slow it down.
Dear Heather and Amy, it looks as though our mooring team will be happy to carry out the deployment itself, which is great news. They have some detailed questions below. Can you please reply to Paul and Dan directly? Left parent, CC me, please write parent.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah, so
that I could understand.
Yeah, okay. That's, you get used to it.
So yeah, that's a pretty significant adaptation on your part as well to understand like you said, to me sounds like a pretty robotic voice talking very, very quickly, but I guess that's the equivalent for most of us of kind of brainlessly skimming most of our emails, kind of speed reading.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it does take time to get used to it and to be able to speed it up and still get the gist. And I do change the speed. There's a very nice key on my keyboard for speeding it up and slowing it down. And so I can, for emails, which sometimes don't take all my brain power, right? I can speed it up a lot. So as you say, it's like skim reading. But if I have to read a scientific paper that way, I have to slow it way down, you know, and sometimes almost read like one sentence at a time, stop, you know, process, and then read another sentence at a time, depending on the level of detail.
You were mentioning that your computer actually reads back to you as you type. And my first thought was, I bet you catch a ton of mistakes that the rest of us who are barely looking at our screen never do catch.
That is true. It was a surprise to me, and I think to other people, that I was able to pick up on a lot of typos, basically, because they come across sounding wrong. It's very obvious when there's a misspelling, and if you read that misspelling the way it's misspelled, it would
get a garbled mouthful.
Yeah, you get a completely. And so it's kind of surprising. I wouldn't have thought I would be able to contribute much in terms of proofreading, but it has worked out great.
That's Amy Bauer. She's a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. I'm Heather Goldstone. If you'd like to join our conversation, our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking this hour with Amy Bauer. She's a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. She's also legally blind, and she's overcome her vision impairment with the use of technology and a lot of practice. Amy, the thing I just can't wrap my mind around is, you know, you go to sea, you deploy these instruments, you get data, you come back to your lab, and you can read email and you can write documents. But how do you actually grapple with your data if you can't graph it and see that graph, if you can't visualize it? I mean, I think that's been such a huge thing in the past few years. You know, we now have an entire field of journalism, data journalism, that's all about visualizing data. How do you grapple with it when you can't visualize it that way?
That is the biggest challenge, I will admit. And as my vision has declined, it's become even more of a challenge. In the past, when my vision was a little better, if I zoomed in on the graphic, I could see it. There's another very valuable tool called a closed-circuit TV or video magnifier, which is specifically designed for visually impaired people. You can put any document or a graphic or text on a tray, and a camera looks at it and displays the image on a screen, and you can increase the magnification. You can change the color scheme to make it more contrast. And I use that for years, and I still do use it. If a graphic is done well, from my point of view, in that it has high contrast, it's not super complicated.
I mean, really, that's the rules of a good graphic for anybody. It's just even more important for you.
It's totally true. Totally true. I try to remind myself of that sometimes when I feel discouraged, like, I have to ask people to make their graphics simpler or better color scheme. And then I remember that actually that will help everybody absorb the information more quickly when they're looking at a graphic.
I mean, is that how much of a communication barrier is that? Because if you go to a scientific conference, I mean, that's all day, every day at the conference is either posters with little tiny graphics on them, or you're sitting in a big conference room with people flashing up, you know, PowerPoint presentations with more and more data graphics. How much of that information are you able to really absorb and benefit from?
These days, the visual part, not much. I'm mostly in listening mode. And I picture, especially at large conferences with many short presentations, I think of those presentations as advertisements by each scientist, including myself. And I listen, and then someone will speak about something. Oh, that's particularly interesting to me. Then I will seek out the scientist who gave the presentation and have a conversation about it, which can also lead to more collaboration as well. So I am at a little bit of a disadvantage, though, at these meetings. I often travel with one of my research associates who, if a really particularly interesting presentation is being given, I can lean over and say, oh, what is that graphic? You know, what are they showing on that graphic? And so I do get some cited assistance. And I should mention that that is important to my career in several aspects. And traveling, going to these large conferences, finding the conference room, reading the abstract booklet, which is not a booklet, it's more like an encyclopedia these days, and trying to navigate big conferences. Having a cited guide is really helpful.
I wonder on the flip side of, you know, saying you're at a disadvantage, because you are working with the data in a different way or having to visualize it in mm-hmm. a different way, are there insights, kind of like the proofreading that you
right.
catch that others don't, are there insights that you might be able to get out of a data set that others don't?
Yeah. I'm not sure about that. There aren't heck of a lot of opportunities where we look at a graphic together, or you know, that we I discuss with another scientist something. But I feel like I have either developed or had already a pretty good ability to visualize in my mind what data look like. So I think that I've been able to overcome the disadvantage of not being able to see it, at least to some extent, by having someone describe it and then visualizing it in my mind. And I think I can still ask relevant questions about the data of the postdoc or the graduate student or the fellow scientist that I'm talking to about the data. I also do still write my own code, my own computer programs to display the data. And I find that gives me a very intimate connection with the data that I feel is very important for the successful analysis and interpretation of the data is hands on the data, basically. Even though the final product is difficult for me to see, I can talk with a sighted person and say, well, doesn't this show, you know, this, that, and the other thing? So using a combination of adaptive techniques, I think I've been able to continue to access data, even graphical data.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is oceanographer Amy Bauer. She's a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Our toll-free phone number at Living Lab is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Amy, back as an undergraduate, when you first found out that you, or I guess it was in graduate school when you got the official diagnosis, and you were feeling like you might have to give up this career choice, what changed your mind?
What changed my mind was an interaction with a low vision specialist in Boston who, unlike the doctor that gave me the diagnosis, who he didn't bother to find out what kind of oceanography I was in. I think he assumed I was going to be involved with microscopes and things like that. That first doctor said, oh, you should change fields, you know, forget it. And that was devastating. I was crying on my way out of that doctor's appointment for sure. And for some weeks afterwards. But then I was also seeing a low vision specialist who had exactly the opposite attitude. He said, what do you want to do? Let's figure out how to do it. And for example, he was the one that introduced me to this video magnifier to zoom in on graphics and text. And it was mainly his attitude, though, that, you need a special kind of glasses for reading. Let's try these three different kinds. And his very positive attitude just fed me and sustained me in those early days of being unsure about how this would go on. And I guess the only other, sometimes I think ahead and I go, oh, shoot, how am I going to deal with this as my vision gets worse? You know, I just couldn't imagine. And so I try to keep my head in the present. What are the challenges today? What are the ways we can address those vision issues today and not worry about 5 years, 10 years from now? Because you never know. You know, new technologies are coming along all the time, and even medical advances in implantation and things like that. So I try not to think too far ahead.
With the extended transition that you've gone through and the fact that you did spend two decades of your life as a fully seeing person. Mm-hmm. Do you think that you can serve as a bit of a bridge, perhaps, between the seeing population and the visually impaired population, and particularly within the sciences, to try to help facilitate perhaps new adaptations or finding ways for people to make this work? I mean, you've kind of done it both ways.
Yes, that's quite a good point. I do believe I can be a bridge. There are many young people and students today who are interested in science and pursuing their studies and careers as visually impaired scientists starting at a very young age, visually impaired at a very young age. The technology has come a long way, and I think the public awareness has come a long way towards facilitating those dreams for those students. I always wonder, like, if I had been visually impaired from the age of 5 or 10, you know, how may have my interest in science been evolved? It's hard to say. We'll never know. But having started my training and my studies, you know, as a visually normal person, I think it has given me that ability to see it both ways, so to speak. And I think that has helped.
Is there a broader community of visually impaired scientists that you have connected with over the years?
I wouldn't say a broader community. There is a community, a very small community. But starting probably about 15 years ago, I actively started to reach out to scientists, especially those who were more senior than me, to start asking questions. How are you doing this? How do you access graphics? And I found a few online. I have definitely found a few more since then. Even quite recently, I made a special trip to North Carolina to visit a computer scientist who works for a scientific applications company, or statistics company. But he's visually impaired, but he is working on special tools to help scientists like me access graphics. And I wanted to see what he was working on for research in this specific area. So that's really great. And we boost each other up, too. You know, he knows I'm out there in the field trying to use tools such as what he is developing, and that gives him more incentive to develop them and make them work seamlessly. And so the community is growing slowly. And now suddenly I find myself as one of these senior people that I don't know how that happened.
Always amazing how
I know. So now I'm hoping to be available to junior people and students to help them answer those questions that I had, you know, 20 years ago about how do you do this?
Have you experienced opposition or even discrimination from colleagues in the sciences?
I don't believe so. Not at all. If there was any, I'm pretty sure it was unintentional. I've never, except for that first doctor, believe it or not, who tried to steer me away, I have never had anyone come up to me and say, you shouldn't be doing this, or you can't do this, never. And I am grateful for that, and for my colleagues and my community for not doing that. At Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, in fact, it has been exactly the opposite. And the institution as a whole has been very supportive and has made very generous accommodations in terms of providing funding for special equipment, for the special software like JAWS. They pay for that, so I don't have to pay for it out of my research grants. They've paid for sighted guides for travel on cruises as well as to conferences. In fact, back some years ago, they received an Employer of the Year award from the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their support of me and other people at HUI with disabilities, vision disabilities. So I have been fortunate in that I have not had any significant discouragement. In fact, quite the opposite.
You've spent a lot of time, a fair bit of time, on ships and at sea, but Now you're going to be competing in the World Blind Sailing Championship. What inspired that?
Actually, that already happened. We did compete in September last year. And I have always loved dinghy racing. I was on the Tough Sailing team when I was there as an undergraduate, and I was pretty much, I had a little bit of vision issue there, but not much. And I love racing. I love the competition. I love being on the water and sailing and the problem solving that goes along with racing and figuring out how to get around the course the fastest. And so once I started to lose my sight, I thought, oh, that's the end of that one, you know. But in fact, there is a pretty robust community of blind and visually impaired sailors and sailing competitors, especially in Boston. So that's where I was introduced to the idea, and I did some. And the boats will have, in some cases, two-sided guides and two blind sailors on them. And with a team, I went to Chicago for the World Blind Sailing Championships, and we actually won.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Much to my own surprise. There were about five or six countries represented, Australia, New Zealand, big sailing countries, Canada, I think the UK, and the US. Yeah, we won in the B1 division, which is the most significantly visually impaired sailors. So that was pretty exciting. It was pretty awful, though, because in some ways, because I got incredibly seasick.
Really?
Which was embarrassing. Here I am, an oceanographer, goes on cruises across the Atlantic Ocean, you know, and I was on Lake Michigan. But it was really rough. We had horrible, horrible weather, and just the motion was quick and nasty, and that's all it took.
Does that put to rest the idea that seasickness is a disconnect between what you're seeing and what you're feeling?
Yeah. I don't know if my having a vision impairment made it worse or not, but I definitely felt bad.
That's Amy Bauer. She's a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be joined by a teacher with 40 years of experience at the Perkins School for the Blind. She's involved in a science program that Amy Bauer started. That's when Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Kate Fraser has been a teacher at the Perkins School for the Blind for the last 40 years. And since the 1990s, she's been teaching science there. In 2006, Amy Bauer asked her to help start a new program. They launched Ocean Insight a year later. It's a hands-on program meant to get sight-impaired and blind kids excited about science. Kate Fraser is joining us by phone to talk about it. Welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you. Hello.
So, Kate, how does the Ocean Insight program work?
It involves a number of different components, including Amy visiting with our students here at Perkins, as well as our traveling to Woods Hole and meeting with Amy and the exhibit center staff, as well as a number of scientists that Amy has connected us with over the years. I also, at 1 year, participated with Amy in a research cruise to the North Atlantic, where we put out moorings in the North Atlantic.
And what was that like for you?
I also got seasick on that trip.
Well, you know, when you're in the North Atlantic, I think that's completely understandable.
It was a big adventure in my life. It really was. I enjoyed being able to actually do hands-on research on a research vessel and to be part of the scientific crew that was putting out the mooring and recording data. And it just was a marvelous experience to see how the scientific team and the crew of the ship worked together as a team. And just it was an amazing, memorable experience.
Amy, what prompted you to approach Kate and the Perkins School? At what point did you say, right, I'm ready to start mentoring the next generation of visually impaired scientists?
There was a very distinct moment when I had a eureka moment. I don't know how long ago now, maybe 15 at least years ago, Congress mandated a new criterion for which research proposals would be judged. The first and naturally, and has been for a long time, criterion is called Criterion 1. It's the intellectual merit of any research proposal. But the second criterion, which was brought in this 15 years ago or so, is called Criterion 2, and it's the broader impacts. Your proposals are now judged on the broader impacts. And we scientists at first had some difficulty. Broader impact. Okay. I mean, we know in our scientific minds, you know, yes, we hope we're contributing to scientific knowledge. But now Congress wants to see more immediate impacts to the beyond your research community. So there was one of the vice presidents at Woods Hole was meeting with a bunch of scientists and was trying to coach us on how to find such broader impacts activities. And he said, try to think of something that you would be particularly good at. So I thought about it and I said, well, I could reach out to visually impaired students as a visually impaired scientist myself and help to get them excited about science, about earth science and oceanography in particular, and also help them to find a passion. I'm passionate about what I do, and I'm sure that passion helps to fuel my career. They may not want to be scientists, but they need to find something to help them overcome the challenges they're going to experience. So at that very moment, I said, I know about Perkins. I had a friend who worked at the library there, and I contacted her, and she put me in touch with Kate. And then we started the conversation and came up with the framework for Ocean Insight together.
Kate, how did you come to be teaching science at the Perkins School?
A number of years ago, my late husband was friends with the director here and was aware that I had a background in working with adults who are blind. So I came to Perkins and brought that talent here. Then a number of years ago, I met with the human resources director here who realized that I had certification in science teaching and a great interest in that. And he offered me a position as a science teacher to replace someone who is retiring. And it's been the greatest experience of my life to be working with these wonderful students and being able to open up the world of science to them.
What kinds of hands-on activities do you do with your students in the sciences? And perhaps what were you doing with them before you started Ocean Insight?
We very much are lucky to have a number of adaptive equipment available, and my primary focus has been to make science accessible to all students. So we would, in our earth science and physics classes, to talk about the science most closely related to what Amy does, we would be studying about differences in temperature, differences in salinity of water, and we would be working with talking thermometers and other instruments that would work. About 10 years ago, it's about the same time that I started working with Amy on a very close basis, I became aware of some talking data collecting sensors that were available to students in school to use. And we started using those so that we could replicate some of the measurements similar to the ones that Amy uses in her research, such as temperature and salinity. We also here teach biology and chemistry, as well as general science to all our students. And we create 3D models and hands-on materials to teach everything.
You're going to have a group actually coming to Woods Hole soon. Amy,
yes.
What will these students be doing while they're actually in Woods Hole?
Well, we hope to have even two groups coming in June. The first is with the Perkins Outreach Program. These will be students who attend public schools, but who are supported by a teacher of the visually impaired or other teachers from Perkins in their public schools. And they're coming for a day, and the theme of the day will be marine mammals. These kids will be in grades 1 to 6, about 10 to 15 students. And we have a great lineup for them, including the Whale Mobile, which is a life-size inflatable humpback whale that you can actually walk through. So they'll be able to get a sense of the actual size of whales. We have a presentation by a former HUI MIT joint program student who's now a professor at Savannah State, who has developed a special presentation for visually impaired students on marine mammal sounds. We found that the blind and visually impaired students are super interested in acoustics, anything to do
seems
with...
Seems logical.
It does. And they're very tuned in, so to speak. So we're going to have a presentation there. We're going to do a whale blubber hands-on activity, which is completely tactile. And then the second group, which will be hopefully some of Kate's biology students, we hope to actually take them out on a vessel into Vineyard Sound, where we take some samples. We use Kate's talking laboratory sensors. We dredge up some creatures from the seafloor, and the students explore those tactily. And we talk about the tides and ocean currents, and I talk a little bit about my research. I usually bring some of the instruments that I use so that they can explore them with their hands.
Kate, what are the students' responses to these kinds of experiences? I mean, we're seeing in, very broadly across the country, I think a huge surge in interest in science-related careers. This has become a major focus at any number of different levels. Are you seeing that same thing within your students at Perkins School?
Yes, we are. And first of all, one of the best things that has happened is that Amy is a tremendous role model for our students. They are very interested in the fact that she, in fact, uses much of the same technology that they use, and they become very interested in pursuing, as Amy mentioned earlier, developing passions about what they are interested in. The times that we spend with Amy are usually the highlight of the school year for all of the students, and they are very motivated and very interested in the sciences, and a number of them have expressed interest in entering science-related careers. Amy has also pointed out that you don't need to be a senior scientist to be involved in science. There are a number of careers that are available as part of a science team.
Well, and as someone who talks about science for my own living, I appreciate that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Many of my students would like your job.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, one thing that Amy has mentioned is the importance of her relationships, her working relationships with sighted scientists who are able to discuss data, to help with aspects of the hands-on research that she may not feel comfortable doing. Do your visually impaired or blind students get a chance to mix with sighted students in any way and perhaps experience that kind of relationship and synergy?
As often as possible. Particularly in the outreach program, a number of our students will meet with students in the outreach program who are from public school and make connections back into their own community with students who are not visually impaired or blind and share with them their interest in the sciences.
Amy, you've been... Oh, sorry, you wanted to say
Well, yeah,
that.
We had one activity that was along those lines,
yes,
which I would love to do again. We had a student from Woods Hole, not visually impaired student, who brought his science fair project to a field trip of Perkins students that we had here. And he explained and brought his equipment and he brought all of his, he discussed the purpose of his science fair project and how he did it. The Perkins students also have to do a science fair project. And so I hope it was inspirational for them to see, oh, this is how kids in public schools who are not visually impaired are doing a science fair project. I thought that was a positive experience all around, actually on both sides.
I think so, too. Think so, too, very much. And yes, our students do projects every year for our science fair. This was our 10th annual science fair this year, and Amy, in fact, has been a judge at a number of our science fairs.
Well, and I imagine, to your point, Amy, that it's inspirational in both directions, that for these students, who are coming in and seeing what visually impaired students are capable of doing. I imagine that can be a really eye-opening and inspiring experience to see, you know, if they can do these things that we might not expect to be possible when you can't see, because when at least for me anyway, it's something that you take so for granted to be able to see the world around you, to realize what these students are capable of doing is really quite inspirational.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. Also, having the not visually impaired students have to describe their work in a way that a blind student can understand is a skill, I think, that will
absolutely
serve them well in many situations.
Now, Kate, I understand that the that there are some challenges for this program, in particularly a staffing shortage at Perkins. What's going on there?
Yes. We rely heavily on teaching assistants to help us, and currently we are looking for people who are interested in working at Perkins School for the Blind in a teaching assistant capacity with our students, both in our residential program and day programs.
Amy, we have about 2 minutes left here. I wonder if you have words of wisdom, perhaps for students that won't be here in 2 weeks on this, this program, with regard to finding your passion and following that regardless of the obstacles that you face.
It's for any student really at all. This is a bit of more specific advice for career preparation, and that is to work on computer skills as much as possible. The screen reader JAWS that we discussed earlier, screen magnification, these products are readily available now and give blind students a lot of access to information. And that is my usual my number one flag that I wave when I meet with the students. It's a window to the world. It is for all of us. But for blind students in particular now, it's completely accessible. And they need to make sure as they prepare for college and or the job market that they have those skills really up to snuff. As far as finding your passion, I guess what's worked for me is the one day at a time attitude and not falling into assumption thinking that assuming, well, I'm visually impaired, I can't do that. Keep it open. You know, keep your mind open. Never say never. And don't let other people say that, too. And I guess finally, again, a little bit of career advice is when you start to explore college and jobs is go prepared to every interview with how you're going to adapt, what adaptive software you're comfortable with, what skills you've learned in high school to overcome your vision impairment, and be ready to talk about those so that a future employer will understand, okay, this person's ready for the workforce.
Sounds like solid words of wisdom for anyone visually impaired or otherwise. That's Amy Bauer. She is a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Also with us, Kate Frazier. She's a teacher at the Perkins School for the Blind and has been for 40 years, since the 1990s. She's also been the science teacher, and for the past several years, she and Amy Bauer have been working on their Ocean Insight program. Kate and Amy, thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.